Welcome to episode 5 of All of Your Business with Michael Jonas.
These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of our business owners whose currents rise tides to lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. Today's show is brought to you by Intentional Espresso Company, the mobile espresso and catering cart servicing the greater Portland, Oregon area by serving quality handcrafted beverages. On this episode of the show, we have Chris Aosa from Do Good Multnomah. Do Good Multnomah is a nonprofit organization that provides low-barrier emergency shelter to homeless veterans in Portland, Oregon. All of Your Business is hosted by creator and executive producer Michael Jonas.
Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. How's your winter going?
I look at winter in the frame of severe weather and winter shelter. Mm-hmm. So we have one more month. At the end of March, winter's over. So far, so good. It's been a busy one, though.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So I definitely know more about your adulthood mm-hmm. than, you know, when you were younger. How did you end up becoming an Air Force veteran?
Yeah. I wish I had a more patriotic story. My grandfather is a Navy vet. He was in the Korean War. We're actually lifting a building that should open next month or in the next month and a half, and we're going to name it after him. It'll be the Bright Tongue Building, which I'm really excited about. So I always looked up to him. My oldest brother is an Army vet. And again, I wish I had a more patriotic story, but I grew up in a family of eight. There were six siblings, and we were poor. We were dirt poor. So in upstate New York, where I grew up, went to school, nobody talked about college unless you were a more wealthier, you know, child to be able to afford that, a family to afford it. So I knew I wanted to do something to get out of the area, and if college wasn't going to be an option, I looked at the military, and I definitely was strategic about which branch, and the Air Force was most appealing to me. When I went into the Air Force, I chose to be a security police because I had family members that were, local police officers, New York State police officers, and I was like, you know what, that's a career path that I would love to choose. To dive into. Unfortunately, when I went into the Air Force, became a security police, and then was done with my military career, being a police officer was the last thing that I wanted to do. So went a different route.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for serving.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so...
you know what? Let's go back. I never know what to say when somebody says thank you for serving. You're welcome just seems really, really pretentious. And so most of the time, I'm just like, yeah, thanks. Yeah, no worries. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't expect some sort of profound reply. Yeah. So you're welcome is fine.
I mean, as a non-vet, when you say thank you for your service, what's an appropriate response that you want to hear?
I'm honestly fine with you're welcome.
Okay.
Yeah, my dad used to say I appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay.
When people would tell him.
Sure.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, I definitely appreciate it. I mean, it's one of those things where I think it's very nice when people thank me or other veterans for my service or their service. I just don't have a response.
Yeah.
I got to find that. As soon as I hear the perfect response, I'm going to coin it. I'm going to take it. And
thanks for being you.
Absolutely. Yes.
Or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. How long were you in the Air Force for?
4 years.
4 years. So you did that, and then you got out, and then your choice was be a cop or do something else?
That's correct. So I literally had no idea what it is that I was going to do when I left the military. You know, that's a story that I hear so often is folks, when they are transitioning out of the military back into real world, real society, without a real strong family support, friend support, anything. You got a job lined up. It's easy to get lost, and a lot of people do. I was stationed in Tucson, Arizona, and all of my friends and family were back east, and I chose to move back east. I didn't want to live in Arizona. So I couch surfed on my oldest brother's couch for like 6 months. And then I got a job at a local gym. I was in shape. I actually became a certified personal trainer, a horrible one, you know. And then I just, you know, went back and forth with what I wanted to do with my life. My younger brother was in art school in Philadelphia, and he's like, hey, come on down, live with me. I did. Still didn't know what I was doing. I ended up joining the Utah Conservation Corps. So I got to live in a tent for a year doing trail maintenance, which was absolutely fantastic. I absolutely loved it. So at that point in time, I decided that I knew what I wanted to do. So when I moved back to Philadelphia after living in Utah for a year, I went to Temple University and got a degree in environmental studies because I was like, this is what I want to do. I fell in love with it. The interesting thing is while I was at Temple, in the Department of Environmental Studies, you can cross list and take classes with geography and urban studies. So I started to do that, found really quick that I could double major. So I did that. And in the Geography and Urban Studies department, I took an internship course. Found an internship at a local food bank, which is called Philabundance. It was the largest, it still is the largest food bank in Philadelphia area, that's southeastern Pennsylvania. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with working with this disenfranchised population, this vulnerable population. And I think that that's where it sort of lit a fire. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And so then after, it sounds like you worked at several nonprofits.
Yeah. So at the time that I graduated from Temple, I had met my wife, got married. She had some friends out in Portland. We were tired of Philadelphia at the time. So we said, let's make a change. She is a nurse. She applied for a job, got an offer pretty much within a week or two at OHSU. I said, okay, let's go to Portland. It's fantastic. So move here. She's doing great. I couldn't find a job to save my life. I mean, I'm talking even applying at Starbucks. Mm-hmm. You know, this is 2009, right near the recession or in the recession. You know, a veteran, honorable discharge, two undergraduate degrees, couldn't get a job at Starbucks. So I think 6 months after really, really searching and feeling like a pathetic loser, my wife said, you know, why don't you just volunteer and do something, spend your time, and then, you know, we can figure this out. So I saw a TriMet bus once go by, and it had a poster, you know, side placard of Portland Rescue Mission. I was like, you know what, I could do that. So it was right around Thanksgiving time, called up, and I had to go to a volunteer orientation. And then they called me and they said, hey, do you mind cooking some turkeys and tearing them apart and whatever? And I was like, yeah, I can do that. So cooked some turkeys, tore them apart. And then the next time I was there, I was in what they called their GROW. It was guest relations office. And I got to actually hang out with some people experiencing homelessness. And I remember the night manager seeing me interact with these folks. And he's like, you're pretty good at this. Do you want a job? And I was like, fuck yeah, I want a job. So my very first sort of dive into homeless services is that Portland Rescue Mission during the winter as an overnight shelter manager. So what that entails is you are one of two people. So there's two people on staff for an overnight shift, and the shelter can accommodate anywhere from like 100 to 130 people, which was absolutely crazy. So, but it was fun. It was exciting.
Why do you think you were good at that and that was noticed?
I don't, you know, to be honest, how do I say this without sounding – well, I'm just going to say it. So a lot of folks that volunteer with individuals that are experiencing homelessness, you know, in that shelter, it sounds very exotic. It's sort of like a glamorized kind of – I went to the homeless shelter and I served meals and I got to hang out. You can tell when a volunteer is doing this for the first time, they're scared shitless. Like they are like, what is going on? But for me, it was like, these are human beings. I'm going to treat them like a human being. I'm no different than they are, and this is cool. So I think that that's
Do you think part of that is your childhood or Air Force training or that job that you had in the wilderness?
Yeah, I don't think it was any of those things. I think either you got it or you don't. I think it's one of those characteristics that you look at another individual and you say, okay, you're a human being, I'm a human being, and I'm going to treat you like a human being. So I don't – it was definitely not something that I received in my upbringing, and it definitely wasn't something that I received in the Air Force. So I don't know where I got this. So I mean, I have other siblings. Like I said, I'm one of six, and my youngest brother actually moved to Portland a couple years after we did, and he jumped right into the same field. First job, Portland Rescue Mission. Second job, Transition Projects, where I was at, and then third job, he jumped on to Do Good after it was. So he has it, and he gets it. He was never in the military, so I don't know. It's just I think it's one of those characteristics that you either have it or you don't. So,
sure.
I don't know.
Well, tell me, how do you go from being a volunteer to working at the Portland Rescue Mission to deciding I'm going to open my own nonprofit?
Yeah. So this is going to sound extremely judgmental, but it's not. So everywhere that I went, the three nonprofits that I worked at, you know, from 2009 all the way up to 2015, they had fantastic things to offer. Not only me, but, you know, individuals that were currently living on the streets, literally homeless, chronically homeless. It was sort of like a boot camp training for me to see what the resources were, you know, and how we were able to disseminate and share those with, you know, participants. But unfortunately, at every single place, there was always something lacking. And that's what got me to leave one place and to go to another. You know, and then you get a little bit more of an education, a little bit more experience, and then there's something still lacking, so you're looking for that next opportunity. By the time I got to the third place, and that same thing was lacking, and again, I'm not, you know, running a nonprofit is extremely, extremely difficult, and I think it's really easy to sit back and say, well, they did this wrong, or, you know, I wish that they did something different with the money or whatever. Like, maintaining funding on a giant scale that some of these nonprofits were maintaining is it's almost impossible. It's extremely difficult. But what I was seeing was, because of the funding sources, it seemed to me that it was easier for folks to be screened out as opposed to screened in. And then, you know, being a veteran and seeing all these veterans falling through the cracks due to, you know, their discharge type. Maybe they weren't honorably discharged. Maybe they had a dishonorable discharge. Or the other thing, too, in Oregon, there's you know, the lack of active duty stations. So they were just, and I'm just saying just, they were just reservists, or they were National Guards. And so they weren't able to screen into these programs, too. So by the time, you know, 2015 rolls around, I have this sort of built up angst and frustration where it says, okay, even if I have something small, I'm going to try and catch these individuals that are falling through the cracks.
Sure.
So
part of it was that the services weren't being offered to everybody who maybe needed them.
Sure.
Or maybe there was a different way of providing these services.
Absolutely. Yep. And I wasn't trying to, my goal was not to compete with any nonprofit that were serving any individuals. My goal was to fill the gaps. So,
and you mentioned before that running a nonprofit is tough. I mean, it is certainly.
Yes.
How do you have conversations with people who say, oh, I want to open a nonprofit?
Yep. Yes. So it's funny. I've actually had plenty of conversations. You know, I have individuals that are, you know, I'm very close to, and they actually refer to me as their mentor. When they introduce me to other people, they're like, oh, this is Chris, my mentor. And I'm like, no, I'm just your friend. Let's do that. I don't even like when people refer to me. They're like, oh, this is Chris, he's my boss. I'm like, no, I'm just a person. I'm Chris. It's okay. So, you know, I think first and foremost, what an individual is trying to do, you know, is extremely important, obviously. You know, if it's something that is missing in the community of services or resources, I definitely am more apt to be positive and give them a push and say, this is some of the things that I've done to be successful. And then I will definitely share all the things that I've done that have been a headache or been unsuccessful. But, you know, I've had also conversations where people are like, you know what, I want to run a shelter, too. And I always have questions. I'm like, OK, well, what population do you want to serve? And they're like, well, yeah, I don't know. And I'm like, OK, well, let's start with that. You know, I remember very early on in the stages with Do Good being able to identify the population I wanted to serve. I want to serve veterans experiencing homelessness that need access to emergency shelter, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing that they aren't getting somewhere else. I identified that population. I identified the population first, and then I went after the funding. I know this is what I want to do. Now I need to figure out how to fund it. A lot of individuals that I will have a conversation with, they will say, oh my goodness, did you see this funding source or this grant? I'm going to go after that. And then after I have it, I'm going to see what I'm able to do with it. And that's just, to me, I guess that's an old school way of looking at nonprofits, mm-hmm. where you say, well, I have a funding source, and then who am I able to serve with it? And I just, to me, that doesn't make sense. You know, mm-hmm. I think if you want to have a successful business at all, you identify what it is that really gets you going, that sets a fire, and then to see what's available to help support that. So there's one particular individual that I meet with weekly, and she is lighting a fire. She's actually a social worker. She's right now getting her license as a LCSW, licensed clinical social worker. And the gap that she is serving from individuals with TBI, traumatic brain injuries, and severe and persistent mental illness, you know, and then these different way of serving an individual that is literally or chronically homeless, that have different perceptions, and I think that that's a unique way of prescribing some folks what you know what they're battling and what they're going through. But there's such a gap for those services that she is definitely one that I am supporting and pushing to try and be successful. And she's doing it. It's great. But there's definitely other individuals that sort of see the success that Do Good's had. And they're like, well, I can do that. And I'm like, well, let's talk about that. Can you do that? Like,
sure.
You know, what's your support look like? How much do you like hanging out with your family? How much do you like sleep? How much do you like anything else, you know, and then really putting that, putting it in perspective. So,
well, and I know for running any business, for profit, nonprofit, whatever it may be, there is this whole administrative component mm-hmm. that people don't realize.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe someone's really passionate about a cause yeah. and their
that
passion.
I didn't even realize. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But their
yeah.
passion does not involve knowing all the admin that
That's
you have
correct.
To do, you
yeah.
know, not just with grant writing, but with permitting and zoning and HR and marketing and networking. I'm probably missing several things.
Bookkeeping, auditing,
yeah.
insurance, the whole nine yards.
So can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, you just said you
yeah.
had no idea that.
Absolutely. So when we started, so we had our very first contract and opened up our very first shelter that was able to support 13 male identifying veterans, which at the time, I remember being, so frustrated that the space that we wanted to utilize after the fire marshal did the walkthrough and they do a calculation of each individual gets 35 square feet and they said, okay, in this space, you can serve 13. And I remember being so frustrated. I'm like, 13, that is so small. I look back at it now, and it was a lifesaver, because if the very first program that I tried to manage without any experience of this sort of other administrative bookkeeping, you know, huge component, probably would have derailed and would have been a failure. But because we were able to start very, very small, and I was the only full-time employee, which was bonkers looking back at it now. And then being able to contact, you know, the bookkeeper and the tax person and say, hey, we are very, very small. This is small. And it was extremely affordable, but being able to subcontract, because I wasn't going to do that in-house. And that's another conversation I have with folks is like, surround yourself with talented people, whether it be on your board or whether it be just people that you can subcontract that know this stuff. This is their job. You know, I had my hands full learning ins and outs of stuff that I've never dealt with before. I can't do that 100%. I can learn new craft, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60%. But if I was doing 100% all the time, it's just impossible to juggle. So you learn as you go, and then you realize some of the entities that you subcontract out are also small. So when you grow, you kind of have to change and find other organizations or businesses and companies that can help accommodate that growth and change. So
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about homelessness in general mm-hmm. and the veteran population, because yeah. it seems like with the people you're serving, there's both things, right?
There's more than both things.
It definitely makes it a lot more challenging or complex.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So how does the intersection of both issues arise? So being a veteran, having issues related to veteran related, mm-hmm. whether it's PTSD, whether it's yep. A brain injury,
yep.
Physical injury,
yes.
and then combine with the homelessness
yep.
and also just the reality of coming back.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different things that we can unpack here. So first and foremost, when you engage with a veteran that is literally homeless, that they are living on the streets, and maybe they've been living on the streets for a few days, a couple weeks, months, or sometimes years, and I'm talking decades, there is a reason, a logical and very good reason for them to be where they're at. And I think the very first thing that gets any organization in trouble is when they try to sort of typecast, when they try to fit somebody in a box. And that's one of the unique things that Do Good Multnomah tries to do, or we do, is we allow that the individual's story and their narrative to actually take place in their progression, if you will. We would never force somebody into shelter. We would never force somebody into housing because I or anybody, we think that that's what they need or deserve. So, you know, always asking a veteran, you know, do you want to come inside? Do you want to have an opportunity for shelter? And some say yes, and some would rather live in their tent. They don't want to be around anybody else. They have trust issues around organizations, the VA, you know, government, you name it. And then at that time, if they, you know, choose to stay on the streets, we still plant these little seeds like, hey, this is your right. Absolutely. But if you ever change your mind, you know, call us. We're here. And then having access to, and I list them in three different stages, having access to emergency shelter to get those folks right off the street that day, transitional housing, and then permanent supportive housing. And the end goal for us is having every single veteran that wants to be there in permanent supportive housing. It would make me probably the happiest person in the world if somebody called me up and said, hey, we no longer have funding for emergency shelters because we don't need them. It'd be great. So you have veterans that may be suffering from severe and persistent mental illness, from PTSD, military sexual trauma. And then, you know, there are veterans that are either self-medicating due to their afflictions or, you know, just have addiction issues in general. So that exacerbates that. And then you have, you know, these same individuals who have been chronically homeless for years, that have built community on the streets. And then you're trying to pluck them from the streets and put them into, let's say, housing, for instance. You know, everybody talks about the housing first model, which I, you know, prescribe to. I think it's a great model. Let's get this individual off the streets and into housing and get them stable. But housing first, and this is the coin of a phrase that my very, very good friend uses all the time, so I want to give Andy credit. It's housing first, not housing only. So housing first works with individuals that are, you know, that may have a plethora of all of those things that they're battling. It only works if you have the resources, the support services to help that individual maintain housing, build community, get them the mental, medical health resources that they may need, and then understand that they are not going to be this gold nugget of a tenant. They are going to have issues paying their bills, being a good community member. So working in tandem with the property management company as well, saying, hey, I know this individual flooded out their unit, and 9.9 times out of 10, you would be evicting them, but let's work together on this. So, and that's part of, you know, the difficulty of, you know, we can find housing. Housing availability, I'm not going to say it's abundant, it's really not, but we can find housing. It's helping these veterans and other individuals experiencing homelessness maintain housing. And that's why, to me, whenever there's a housing bond or a metro bond or anything that is geared towards the development of affordable housing and they have no support service dollars attached to it, you're almost setting yourself up for failure. I mean, the individuals at that point, you know, when we get all the ones that are one paycheck away or they only need a helping hand in the housing, what we're left with are the individuals, severe and persistent mental illness, addiction issues, 0 to 30 of area median income. So that means that they either have very little income or they're still below, you know, the federal poverty line. And then we're trying to place them in housing, and then we give them a key and we feel great about ourselves, and it's like, good luck. So, and that's why you see this push now, like with the Metro, to push support services attached to affordable housing. So, you know, we have 3 affordable housing projects in the works right now, and every single one of them has a budget for support services. I mean, it's the staffing has to be there, or it's just not going to be successful. So. Mm.
Yeah, that sounds true. And I think part of your job, which is day and night, is figuring out all the different inner workings.
Yes.
All the different organizations, that's all correct. The different people trying to help.
Absolutely.
And so it seems like your intake process would be a little bit deeper or stronger than most nonprofits. Can you tell me a little bit about that? You know, you meet a veteran. How do you and your staff determine, okay, this is a good fit for our services?
Sure. I mean, first and foremost, we will give every single veteran an opportunity to come into any of our programs. And while we have policies and procedures and rules, our one hard and fast rule is to be a good community member. As long as, you know, you come into the space, whether it's a shelter, tiny home village, permanent supportive housing, as long as you come in and you can be a good community member, and that's to the other veterans in the program, to the actual physical space, the building, the volunteers and the staff, we're going to give you an opportunity to engage and stay as long as you need that spot, and then hopefully transition you to somewhere, you know, further down the road. So, you know, most of the veterans that we come in contact with for the first time will come through our emergency shelter. And then it's really great to have these other resources in-house that we can refer them to. You know, we have a lot of veterans that go through our shelter and maybe they're not ready or they don't have the resources themselves to get into permanent supportive housing. But we have this other tiny home village for veterans where we can say, okay, the next step after a shelter where there could be 100 individuals, we're going to, you know, give you an opportunity in this tiny home village where there's 15 to 20 tiny homes. You get your own house. There's kitchen, laundry, shower facilities all on site. There'll be staff there to help you get to that next stage. And then even being successful to place veterans from the tiny home village into permanent supportive housing. You know, we do support services at a building in Oregon City. It was 24 units, and it just opened last October. And we were able to place so many veterans from the tiny home village into this, you know, permanent supportive housing that we staff as well. So it's exciting to have all of those resources in-house. But then there's veterans that get to that shelter stage, and they're like, well, I'm good here for now, you know. And then there's folks that get to that next stage, and they're like, well, this is all I want, you know, for now. And that would be great if there wasn't little over 470 homeless veterans on the streets of Portland every single night. So, you know, I would love to be able to have a spot, a resource for every single veteran. You know, we're pushing a lot of programs right now, and a lot of friends or family or even board members will say, well, Chris, when's enough? When are we good? And I think we'll be good when I can say, okay, you know, any veteran experiencing homelessness in the streets of Portland, Multnomah County, Clackamas County, you know, if they want an opportunity, we have an opportunity. So, or there's an opportunity available to them. Again, I'm not trying to compete with other nonprofits that may be serving veterans. And if there's other nonprofits that are doing the same work and they're able to, you know, get some utilization, some vets in those programs, great. As long as the work is done, I'm happy. So,
can you talk a little bit about all the different people that you work with to get these things done? We've had conversations about this sometimes. You know, there's churches, there's government,
absolutely,
there's neighborhood associations, whether or not you get along with them or not.
Yes.
But
yes.
All these things sort of need to coalesce to make these things happen.
You're absolutely correct. By no means am I sitting here saying, well, I do this work all by myself. My staff and team, as fantastic as they are, they don't do that work by themselves. So, you know, the very first shelters that we opened, and we actually still have one winter shelter and four severe weather shelters that are in churches. You know, that was the very first sort of community organization that I reached out to. And it was a strategic, didn't really have anything to do with the religious component of it. More so it had to do with this building is vacant, in my opinion, 6 days out of the week, you know, and nobody's there in the nights. So can I rent some space from you? And usually their mission is aligned. There are some churches that don't want, you know, homeless folks sleeping in their place. They don't want their carpets dirtied. One policy that we do not waver on is individuals are allowed to bring in their companion animals, service animals, their pets. And so if a church or any other organization says, yeah, we're not going to do that, then we'll look elsewhere. So that's the one thing that I remember being really, really strict about since the beginning. The very first shelter that we opened was a church shelter, but that wasn't the very first church I spoke to. That was probably the 12th or 13th church. And all the churches before, you know, they thought it was a great idea, just not in that neighborhood. Maybe on the other side of the river, and it really didn't matter which side of the river I was currently on. But there's been a lot of great churches, and there are a lot of great churches right now that have a ton of property in Multnomah County, and they're trying to build affordable housing. In fact, where we have our winter shelter in North Portland, it's the Portsmouth Union Church, and they were on a big plot on the corner of Lombard and Fisk, and the church decided to cut their building in half because they didn't need the whole building, and they demolished the other half, and they're building affordable housing on that plot. So
that's really
That's awesome, and I love being a part of that community. It's great. So churches and other community, you know, organizations, from volunteering to food to clothing. I mean, the countless amount of items and resources that get donated to us. It's overwhelming, and it helps us not only maintain our programming, but we can go over and beyond, which is really exciting. So for an organization not to have to worry about spending money on food or household items like toilet paper and cleaning supplies and stuff, where there's people literally out there like looking for opportunities to donate or to give, or and that's huge. It makes it extremely just beneficial for us to be able to continue to do the work that we're doing.
Are these for-profit businesses?
You know,
as
they could be for-profit, they could be non-profit, or they could be just small community groups. You know, so we have a shelter in the Mill Park neighborhood, and that shelter is 110 people. And that neighborhood and the neighborhood association is, I'm just going to say it, is probably the greatest, strongest neighborhood association in Portland. The way that they look at the participants in the shelter and our staff, literally with open arms. I mean, just this past summer, they held a picnic, for lack of better words, a get-together for the neighborhood to come together with the participants in the shelter to just, you know, be,
that's wonderful.
You know, in the neighborhood. These are their neighbors, and that's how they look at it. And that is extremely just so pleasant. And let me tell you, that's the outlier, because there's so many neighborhood associations that I sit with, and it's frustrating. It is absolutely frustrating. I always tell everybody that, you know, whether it's a neighborhood association or whether I'm talking at a elementary school to concerned neighbors, we are not trying to sneak into a neighborhood. I'd never try to sneak into a neighborhood. I need the neighborhood buy-in so a program can be successful. You know, and it's extremely frustrating when a neighborhood will, you know, get together just for the sole purpose of making sure that this program can't happen in their neighborhood.
You know, what are some of their objections?
You know, the easy ones are, well, they don't believe that there is individuals currently experiencing homelessness in their neighborhood. So they feel that we will be bringing that element to their neighborhood, which I'm sorry, if you live in Portland, that is grossly incorrect. Okay. The next is this element of crime and drug use, that we will bring that component into their neighborhood. You know, so we always hear, you know, the easy ones are, well, there's children playing around and you're going to bring in all of this meth use, this drug use, these IV needle use. And then this element of crime. Well, people that are experiencing homelessness, they must be the rapists and the murderers, and that's why they don't have housing, which is grossly incorrect.
Well, and crazy to me, if someone is strong enough to serve to protect you, but then when they come back, that's how they're treated.
Absolutely. And that's extremely frustrating. And then the one that probably it just pains me the most is when people start to talk about their property value and their home value, and that when we bring in a shelter or a tiny home village or a permanent supportive housing project, that it will diminish their current home values. And again, if you live in Portland, it's grossly incorrect. There is no research that backs this up.
So how do you not scream? How do you to all these people?
There's probably been times where I've, you know, been frustrated, and I try to be respectful. I'm okay with individuals bringing concerns. I'm a parent. I have a 9-year-old son, and if there were going to be a program literally in my neighborhood, I would have questions. But I think my favorite rebuttal to that is I lived less than a half a mile away from a shelter that I operated. So it was in my neighborhood. So I understand that. But, you know, not everybody has the luxury of knowing, you know, how a particular program is going to be operated. And so if a neighborhood or a community wants to be a part of the process of, let's say, building our rules and our policy and protocol for that particular project. And if they want to know, you know, what our screening criteria is going to look like, or what our day to day is going to look like, I love those conversations. I will sit down, I will have a cup of coffee with anybody to hopefully diminish these assumptions and these stereotypes.
So the issue is the assumption or the immediate no.
That's correct.
The unwillingness to actually have a conversation about it, be part of it.
Absolutely. And I always ask the same question, because every single project that we have been a part of going into a new neighborhood, they are extremely small in scale. So the last two neighborhood association meetings that I've had to sit at that didn't go so hot, one is a 20 home, tiny home village, you know, and the other is a 35-unit permanent supportive housing. So I love to ask folks, you know, that are obviously living in Portland, because we are putting these projects in Portland, you know, if they feel a sense of duty or obligation as a community member in Portland to help address this crisis, this issue of homelessness and lack of affordable housing. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, you'll get some nods. Like, people will be, you know, they're like, okay, yes, absolutely. I care about my city and I want to be able to help, you know, any way that I possibly can. When push comes to shove, though, and it's literally in their neighborhood right down the block, they're a little bit more, you know, averse to saying, okay, let's do this in my neighborhood. But the logic that I have is, if every different neighborhood, if every different community, you know, that is sort of a patchwork of quilt throughout Portland, we all have these little tiny neighborhoods, and if every single neighborhood said, we're going to do our part, that doesn't mean, you know, lifting a high rise of 100 to 200 units or having a mass shelter, but maybe it is a 20 home, tiny home village, you know, or maybe it's 35 units of permanent supportive housing, where a community can sort of latch on and say, this is the one that we're going to support. This is easy to do, and we're going to make sure that it's successful, and we're going to make sure that they feel like a part of the neighborhood. I think a great example of that is Kenton Women's Village in Kenton. You know, I think in the beginning, then there was a lot of assumptions, some prejudice. But then the community got together and said, you know what? This is going to be ours. This is going to be ours that we are going to support, and we're going to make sure that it's successful. And it has been extremely successful, flourishing, I would use the words. And I think if a neighborhood, a community has that mindset going into it, you know, it only helps a project, a program, be that much more successful.
Thank you for listening to our interview with Chris Aosa from Do Good Multnomah. We want to take just a moment and thank our sponsors. The Equi Institute, queer, trans, and intersex healthcare. The Equi Institute's mission is to empower and improve the health of the LGBTQQI2S communities of the Pacific Northwest. For more information, visit equi-institute.org. We also want to thank Jane Does. Jane Does is your source for professional organization, professional assisting, and Oregon Mobile Notary Services. Follow Jane Does on their social media platforms at Jane Does PDX. And now back to our conversation with Michael Jonas and Chris Aosa.
You went from starting a small nonprofit to contracting with the city, the county. Tell me a little bit about that growth and what that looks like. Does that excite you? Does that scare you?
So the very first contract that we received was actually from the Portland Housing Bureau, prior to the Joint Office of Homeless Services being merged, which is both, you know, from general funding from the city and the county. And instead of doing it separately, they said, well, let's join forces and, you know, let's put all of our funding towards, you know, it could be veteran shelters, family shelters, you know, all these different systems that were at one time either being, you know, contracted out from Portland Housing Bureau or Multnomah County. So our very first contract was from Multnomah County, Portland Housing Bureau, and it was to the tune of $72,000 to do a shelter in the winter. So when I say that I was the only full-time employee, I wasn't trying to be a martyr or a hero. It was all that we could afford. And so that winter, we served a lot of veterans, and we became extremely popular to, you know, the veteran community, in particular those that were male identifying. And they tried other shelters out, and they weren't a good fit. And before we knew it, obviously our wait list was probably 2, 3, maybe even 4 times larger than what we had the capacity for. So the city took notice of that, and they said, okay, we would love to be able to continue this, but can you find a bigger space? So we were only at that church for one season, and by the next fiscal year, July 1st of 2016, we were at a larger space in Rose City Park United Methodist Church, and we jumped from 13 to 25. And so our contract got a little bigger. At that time, I also knew that I just didn't want to be a shelter in the basement of a church. If we were really going to tackle this issue of, you know, veteran homelessness in Multnomah County, I wanted permanent supportive housing. So I started writing grants. I started meeting with developers that were interested in partnering with, you know, Do Good. And so we were successful in getting one grant from Oregon Housing Community Service, OHCS, and that's the Bright Tongue building that will open, you know, later April this year. It's 28 units, all veteran specific, very exciting. So I got excited by that, and then working with other developers and other grants. And so, you know, we have 3 veteran projects in the works, and then we started to also go into Clackamas County. And that wasn't something that we had a strategy. We didn't want to go into Clackamas County. We were like, you know, we know Multnomah County, there's enough veterans here to serve. And what's interesting about that is there was a, you know, they were building a veteran village, a tiny home village in Clackamas County. And they had, you know, released funding. They already identified another nonprofit. And I was speaking at this event on, you know, just local homelessness. And an individual from Clackamas County that was doing this project heard me speak. And he's like, hey, I'd love to have you, you know, come over and chat sometime, maybe with this other organization that's doing this veteran village. And I said, anything that I can do to help veterans be successful, great, let me know. So long story short, we ended up with that contract, you know, and then so we've been there since it opened. And then there was a permanent supportive housing building that was lifted in Oregon City, and we got that contract for support services too. So going from our first contract of $72,000 in November of 2015 to an operating budget of a little over $3 million and over 52 staff seems really, really fast to me. Yeah. And crazy. But, you know, the growth, it also seemed natural. You know, I never, ever went out of my way seeking something. You know, I wrote grants for permanent housing, and I wanted that. But it was also just this sort of this natural growth as well. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all the work that you do.
Yeah.
We ask every guest 5 questions.
Okay.
So it's that time.
Great.
So the first one is, if you were not doing Do Good Multnomah, you were doing some other sort of business, what would you be doing?
Man, you know, it's funny because I get this question asked more times than not. So let's say I had a different profession that was helping to pay the bills and I was still able to volunteer on the side. That's exactly what I would do. But the profession... So I received my master's degree in teaching English as a second language. I had the opportunity to do that at PCC for a little bit. I absolutely loved it. And I think the social dynamic in a community college, especially with individuals that I think probably 100% of them, you know, were born in other countries and were trying to literally struggle to learn English while they're juggling their other daily lives. I loved that aspect, and I would probably be doing that. I'd probably be teaching English. I remember when I went to school and sort of with that same thread of wanting to serve this population, vulnerable population, you know, less fortunate population, and seeing a lot of, you know, whether they were individuals that were, you know, maybe through asylum or other things coming to this country and really struggling, you know, and I think education is one of those resources that should be afforded to everybody. So still working with that disenfranchised population, but in a different aspect. And if it wasn't that, I would probably work at a bookstore. You know, I love to read, and I probably would just have headphones in and just cataloging books and reading as much as possible. So yeah. I don't know.
Well, great. If you had to have a celebrity business partner, famous business partner, who would that be?
You know, I think Keanu Reeves is probably the coolest person.
Yeah,
you know,
he's pretty cool.
And he's also sort of like my Hollywood crush. I love his movies. I can't really grade like how fantastic of an actor. I think he's fantastic, but other people are like, dude, Keanu Reeves, seriously? But then to know everything about him outside of, you know, this glamour Hollywood actor world, I just think he's just like an incredible person. So to have like Keanu Reeves, like, you know, if I was Batman and he's my Robin, or vice versa, I'll be his Robin, you know, I just think would be really, really chill. So.
Yeah, he seems like a great person.
Absolutely.
Who would be in your squad of people, dead or alive?
Man, this is a great question. You know, this is probably going to make me sound so much more full of myself than what I actually am. But I am so enamored by individuals in society that have struggled and felt like they were by themselves struggling. So, you know, like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Gandhi, Abraham Lincoln, you know, those individuals at a round table. And just to say, the struggle's real. Like, how did you deal with that? What did you do while you felt like this was a calling, this was something that you had to do, but you felt very alone at times?
Sure.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, I like that one. That's it's a good one. And it is an interesting group of people, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, sure, absolutely, yeah. You know, I'm just randomly picking, so, yeah.
When you reach a certain level of success, what's your splurge or your guilty pleasure purchase?
Oh, man. You know what? I don't know if I'm not one of those people that goes out shopping. Like I said, I love books and I love bikes. I love riding. Bikes to me are like porn. I could go to a bike shop and just like stare at a new bike. So if I were to buy myself a new bike,
or bikes,
what's that?
Motorcycles?
No, like a cycle, bicycle.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I'd kill myself on a motorcycle. I don't have the, you know. And then when you throw in road rage and whatever, no, that just wouldn't be a bad. That wouldn't be good.
But if Keanu was there,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe I would be in his sidecar probably. I don't really, I love to travel. You know, it's something that I actually get to do with some of my brothers. We went to Peru last year. We're going to go to Banff this summer. So I like to travel a lot. If I were to put money on something, it'd be traveling. Those memories are great. But yeah, I really don't, obviously I don't really care about clothes. So, but you know. Not one of those things. So, yeah. Did I answer the question?
For the listeners, he looks pretty hip with a gray beanie. That answers the question.
Okay.
And I think travel is a great one.
Yeah.
The last question number 5, is what local or national businesses would you like to give a shout out to?
Yeah, so actually, I love veteran-owned businesses, and some of my friends, Alex and Gabe, started a local one, the Legion Motorcycle Company, and it's a DIY. So they actually, both of them were in the same field as me. They were, you know, veterans, and they were doing social work. They were serving veterans that were experiencing homelessness. And then, you know, they just said, okay, enough is enough. I'm going to go out and I'm going to branch out and I'm going to start a business. So they got enough backing and support from community and friends and family, and they opened up a DIY shop. And it's a bar, so it's where, you know, anybody who owns a motorcycle that wants to sort of, you know, wrench out on their own, they're there to help and support. You know, it's actually a storage facility, and then if you want to just have a drink and watch Kung Fu on a Friday night, it's pretty rad.
So, sounds cool.
Yeah, yeah, they're good dudes. So
yeah, well, thank you for doing the podcast.
Yeah,
and as much as you're uncomfortable with me thanking you for your service, thank you for your service as not just a veteran but a strong community member.
Absolutely. You're welcome, Michael.
A very big thank you to Chris Aosa from Do Good Multnomah. Find out more information at dogoodmultnomah.org. We also want to thank our sponsors, the Equi Institute and Jane Does. Episode 5 was brought to you by the Intentional Espresso Company, bringing exceptional coffee and service to your clients and guests. Be sure to visit intentionalespresso.com. And a big thank you to you, our listeners, for checking out another episode of the show. For more information, be sure to go to allofyourbusinesspodcast.com and subscribe to us on your favorite streaming service. All of Your Business is recorded and edited at Track 11 Music in Portland, Oregon.